Državni ispitni center.
Maturità generale 2011.
Prova d'ascolto.
A tutti voi un cordiale saluto. Siamo all'inizio della prova d'ascolto d'inglese.
Questa prova d'esame si compone di due parti, la parte A e la parte B. Per ciascuna parte ascolterete un testo e risponderete poi ad un esercizio che a esso si ricollega. Dapprima leggerete l'esercizio, poi ascolterete ciascun testo per due volte. Potrete cominciare a risolvere l'esercizio già durante l'ascolto. L'inizio e la fine del testo saranno indicati dal seguente segnale acustico.
Scrivete le vostre risposte negli spazi appositamente previsti all'interno della prova, utilizzando la penna stilografica o la penna sfera. Scrivete in modo leggibile. In caso di errore, tracciate un segno sulla risposta scorretta e scrivete accanto ad essa quella corretta. Alle risposte e alle correzioni scritte in modo illeggibile verrà assegnato il punteggio di 0.
Dopo aver completato la risoluzione di ambedue le parti A e B della prova, avrete a disposizione ancora un minuto per compilare il foglio per le risposte per quanto riguarda l'esercizio A. Ricordatevi di indicare solamente una scelta per ciascuna affermazione dell'esercizio. In presenza di più scelte, infatti, alla vostra risposta verrà assegnato il punteggio di 0.
Abbiate fiducia in voi stessi e nelle vostre capacità. Vi auguriamo buon lavoro.
Ascoltate con attenzione. Aprite la prova d'esame.
Section A. You will hear an interview with Peter Carey about his latest book. As you listen to the recording, tick the appropriate column below, then complete the answer sheet according to the instructions on it. You will hear the recording twice. Now read through the statements.
My guest today is the writer Peter Carey. He's won lots of awards, he's gathered critical acclaim and sold an awful lot of books, often books set in his native Australia, though his most recent is largely set in America, where he now lives. I hope you enjoy listening. Peter Carey, welcome to the interview.
Thank you.
Do awards matter much to you?
Well, I could pretend to be really cool and say, well, it didn't really matter, and I could say literature's not a horse race, which it isn't. But of course they matter, and the first most obvious way to me is, you know, when you're writing a book, you really are seriously trying to do something that's going to last. You're trying to do something that's never been done before, that you've never been done before. And anything that could help you support this pathetic delusion is really, really welcome. And yes, they matter enormously.
How do you personally measure the success of your books?
Well, I have to calibrate this depending on the book, don't I? You know, so, you know, it's amazing the books that I've sort of personally judged to be successful, that when I look back, I see the reviews weren't so great and the sales were terrible. And somehow in my mind, I've protected myself from despair by feeling the book was successful. So I think it depends on the case.
You mentioned the reviews there. You do read them, do you?
I really try not to. I think it's a really good idea not to read a bad review. And it's best for somebody else to sort of to take the poison for you so you don't remember it 20 years later. And I do remember 30-year-old reviews that were bad, so, and never the good ones.
Your accent betrays you, Australian-born, but you've lived for, what, 20 years in America now? What do you like about the place?
Well, I don't think I live in America. I think I live in New York, and I think that's a little different. When I leave New York, I don't know quite where I am, but when I'm in New York, well, New York's an extraordinary place with all of the world living there, all of these people with their hearts in two places, and for most of the time, really actually getting on with each other and accommodating each other all the time, every day. And that notion, the river of people and where they are and who they're from, I really, really like. It's culturally an incredibly stimulating place. But I would not have chosen to live in the United States. I was married to a woman who really passionately wanted to live in New York.
But what about the rest of America, though, outside of New York?
Well, I don't know. What is it? I mean, it's all these highways and strange people who believe that God put dinosaurs on Earth to puzzle us. And only a third of them believe that the president's a Christian. And half of them think that he wasn't born in the United States and has a false birth certificate. So this is a very puzzling place to me, and it sort of indicates, among other things, that, you know, you seem to have a very dangerous sort of media monopolies who are intent on keeping a population very, very stupid.
Now you will hear the recording again.
My guest today is the writer Peter Carey. He's won lots of awards, he's gathered critical acclaim and sold an awful lot of books, often books set in his native Australia, though his most recent is largely set in America, where he now lives. I hope you enjoy listening. Peter Carey, welcome to the interview.
Thank you.
Do awards matter much to you?
Well, I could pretend to be really cool and say, well, it didn't really matter, and I could say literature's not a horse race, which it isn't, but of course they matter, and the first most obvious way to me is, you know, when you're writing a book, you really are seriously trying to do something that's going to last. You're trying to do something that's never been done before, that you've never been done before. And anything that could help you support this pathetic delusion is really, really welcome. And yes, they matter enormously.
How do you personally measure the success of your books?
Well, I have to calibrate this depending on the book, don't I? You know, so, you know, it's amazing the books that I've sort of personally judged to be successful, that when I look back, I see the reviews weren't so great and the sales were terrible. And somehow in my mind, I've protected myself from despair by feeling the book was successful. So I think it depends on the case.
You mentioned the reviews there. You do read them, do you?
I really try not to. I think it's a really good idea not to read a bad review. And it's best for somebody else to sort of take the poison for you so you don't remember it 20 years later. And I do remember 30-year-old reviews that were bad, and never the good ones.
Your accent betrays you, Australian-born, but you've lived for, what, 20 years in America now? What do you like about the place?
Well, I don't think I live in America. I think I live in New York, and I think that's a little different. When I leave New York, I don't know quite where I am, but when I'm in New York, well, New York's an extraordinary place with all of the world living there, all of these people with their hearts in two places, and for most of the time, really actually getting on with each other and accommodating each other all the time, every day. And that notion, the river of people and where they are and who they're from, I really, really like. It's culturally an incredibly stimulating place. But I would not have chosen to live in the United States. I was married to a woman who really passionately wanted to live in New York.
But what about the rest of America, though, outside of New York?
Well, I don't know. What is it? I mean, it's all these highways and strange people who believe that God put dinosaurs on Earth to puzzle us. Only a third of them believe that the president's a Christian. And half of them think that he wasn't born in the United States and has a false birth certificate. So this is a very puzzling place to me, and it sort of indicates, among other things, that, you know, you seem to have a very dangerous sort of media monopolies who are intent on keeping a population very, very stupid.
This is the end of Section A. Section B. You will hear a part of a radio program about Icelandic volcanoes. As you listen to the recording, write your answers in note form in the spaces below. Use 1 to 5 words for each answer. You will hear the recording twice. Now read through the questions.
If we didn't know that Iceland was volcanically active, we certainly do now, after an eruption of ash led to air traffic control officials grounding all European flights back in April this year. It's almost inevitable that there will be more eruptions, but whether there'll be another incident where flights are affected depends on the wind. We sent Science in Action reporter Martin Redfern to the land of fire and ice to join volcanologists, checking out another possible candidate.
The rivers of northeast Iceland are often swollen at this time of year by summer rain and meltwater from the great Vatnajökull ice cap to the south. But this year, a blanket of dark volcanic ash across the ice has increased heat absorption and boosted melting. So this river now follows the rough track we'd hoped to take to the Askja volcano. But after a long detour, we were attempting to walk across the jagged, cinder-strewn landscape of the Great Caldera. A colourless, almost lunar landscape, which is why the Apollo astronauts did their training in field geology here. Our guide is Dr. Hazel Reimer from Britain's Open University.
Iceland is made of volcanoes. It only exists because of volcanic activity. And so Eyjafjallajökull, that was erupting earlier this year, certainly hit the headlines, but it's just one of many active volcanoes in Iceland. And this volcano that we're at now, Askja, last erupted in 1961. You can see the huge lava flow that that produced. But it's also produced large ash and tephra eruptions. So tephra is like ash, but larger lumps of like pumice, very light rock that can be thrown up high into the sky and transported considerable distances. And as we drove here, we saw that for many, many kilometres around here, the deposits from the large explosive eruption in 1875.
Bad news had there been jet aircraft then. But what is Askja doing now and in the future? That's what we came to find out.
I'm here to measure gravity. I've been doing this for many years, and I've been looking to see how the acceleration due to gravity actually changes through time here. Now, it changes for lots of reasons. It changes because the ground moves up and down with the volcanic activity. It changes because of the earth tides. And it also changes because of the amount of magma, the molten rock underneath the volcano. And so we're looking to see whether we can see a build-up or perhaps a build-down of the amount of magma underneath this volcano. If there's a build-up, that could be telling us that a new eruption is on the way.
The instrument is incredibly sensitive, measuring gravity to the 8th or 9th decimal place, such that a few centimetres of height difference or the tidal pull of the moon need to be allowed for.
OK, I've got a number. 5529.988.
Now you will hear the recording again.
If we didn't know that Iceland was volcanically active, we certainly do now, after an eruption of ash led to air traffic control officials grounding all European flights back in April this year. It's almost inevitable that there will be more eruptions, but whether there'll be another incident where flights are affected depends on the wind. We sent Science and Action reporter Martin Redfern to the land of fire and ice to join volcanologists, checking out another possible candidate.
The rivers of northeast Iceland are often swollen at this time of year by summer rain and meltwater from the great Vatnajökull ice cap to the south. But this year, a blanket of dark volcanic ash across the ice has increased heat absorption and boosted melting. So this river now follows the rough track we'd hoped to take to the Askja volcano. But after a long detour, we were attempting to walk across the jagged, cinder-strewn landscape of the great caldera. A colourless, almost lunar landscape, which is why the Apollo astronauts did their training in field geology here. Our guide is Dr. Hazel Reimer from Britain's Open University.
Iceland is made of volcanoes. It only exists because of volcanic activity. And so the Eyjafjallajökull that was erupting earlier this year certainly hit the headlines, but it's just one of many active volcanoes in Iceland. And this volcano that we're at now, Askja, last erupted in 1961. You can see the huge lava flow that that produced, but it's also produced large ash and tephra eruptions. So tephra is like ash, but larger lumps of like pumice, very light rock that can be thrown up high into the sky and transported considerable distances. And as we drove here, we saw that for many, many kilometres around here, the deposits from the large explosive eruption in 1875.
Bad news had there been jet aircraft then. But what is Askja doing now and in the future? That's what we came to find out.
I'm here to measure gravity. I've been doing this for many years, and I've been looking to see how the acceleration due to gravity actually changes through time here. Now, it changes for lots of reasons. It changes because the ground moves up and down with the volcanic activity. It changes because of the earth tides. And it also changes because of the amount of magma, the molten rock underneath the volcano. And so we're looking to see whether we can see a build-up or perhaps a build-down of the amount of magma underneath this volcano. If there's a build-up, that could be telling us that a new eruption is on the way.
The instrument is incredibly sensitive, measuring gravity to the eighth or ninth decimal place, such that a few centimetres of height difference or the tidal pull of the moon need to be allowed for.
OK, I've got a number. 5529.988.
This is the end of section B.
Ora avete a disposizione un minuto per compilare il foglio per le risposte per quanto riguarda l'esercizio A.
Siamo alla conclusione della prova d'ascolto d'inglese. Smettete di scrivere, chiudete la prova d'esame e posatela sull'orlo del banco insieme al foglio per le risposte.
Ancora un cordiale saluto.